Good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Anne Umland. I'm a curator in the museum's Department of Painting and Sculpture and organize the exhibition, What is Painting? Contemporary Art from the collection that's currently on view on the sixth floor. It is a distinct pleasure and honor to have the opportunity to introduce to you tonight Chuck Close and Carol Dunham, two distinguished artists whose works, as you see here, are prominently featured in What is Painting on the sixth floor upstairs. On the left, you're looking at Chuck's monumental portrait, Robert, 104,072 of 1973-74. And on the right, Carol Dunham's Ship of 1997-98. Each of these works is, of course, in its own right, an absolutely signature statement. And I thought that rather than spend your time and mine going through the deservedly lengthy list of awards and achievements and accomplishments of each of our speakers, that I would let the works provide the way to introduce them to you. So, to begin with Chuck Close, you're looking at, of course, a work in Robert that can, at this point in time, be described as one of Chuck Close's early works, of a type that first gained him widespread recognition in the early 1970s, an aggressively scaled, systematically detailed portrait that reminds us, if reminding were in fact needed, of the way that Chuck reinvigorated and redefined what was widely perceived in the 70s as a rather moribund, defunct genre of figurative painting by applying a conceptual system to portraiture, arguably one of painting's most traditional modes. I think as you look at this work, and at its aggressive scale, its black and white palette, its 104,072 gridded squares, you are reminded that with works such as these, the closer you, with every step you take toward it, as you see the viewers doing in this picture, the more you are reminded that Chuck's work is as much or more so about code than illusion. I think also in the black and white palette, in the aggressive scale, and in the subject, sort of this anonymous to us, every man, Robert, you get a real sense of the distance and the step taken between this moment in the 70s and works like Andy Warhol's, I can use this clicky thing, sort of glittery, colorful, star-studded celebrity portraits made just a decade earlier, and that are on view in the gallery adjacent to the work where Robert, or the place where Robert hangs. Then, on the right side, Carol Dunham's Ship, painted, of course, some 25 years later, in over the course of a two-year period in the 1990s. What you can't see here is in the left-hand side of the composition. Are a series of dates inscribed on the picture that, just in the same sense that the various traces, the lines, the pentimenti, the overlap, the erasure, all of which serve to figure time and duration, which Dunham has spoken of or referred to as materials, into the work. I think, unlike Chuck Close, whose contemporaries include Saul LeWitt or Philip Glass or Richard Serra, Dunham is an artist who emerged in the 1980s. He was a key figure among what is now widely recognized or touted as a return to painting in that decade, who created works at that point, as Robert Storr has written about, that were both as fully formed and authoritatively deformed, and that in ensuing years has gone on, as you see in Ship, to create an instantly recognizable cast of characters, these amazing deformed, inflated, pneumatic, spurting, spitting, ejaculating, sort of manic figures, and a whole set of procedures, of ways of working, all of which are condensed in Ship. Now, I think these two works seen together, of course, pose all sorts of different approaches to the question posed by this exhibition, what is painting? Just as, of course, these are only two works out of what, in the case of both the artists here, are decades-long careers. I think, considered in combination, they speak to us about broader issues of process, of scale, of time, and of subject matter, of a recognizable sort of subject matter. And those are some of the topics that I hope the three of us might talk together about tonight, or about things I haven't even thought about. That would be even more fun. But first, just to give you an idea of how the evening will unroll, we've asked both Carol Dunham and then Chuck Close to speak to us for 20 minutes or so about their work, past and present. And then after that, the three of us will sort of convene in this little area here and have a conversation. And at the end, we'll open the conversation up to you, the audience, for questions. And we hope that we have a lively, provocative time. So, with no further ado, Carol Dunham. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. I think quite a bit, actually, about why I started to make paintings and why I've done it with such determination for as long as I have. Because it could have, if I think back about what I was like when I was in my 20s, when I first thought I might be an artist, it could have easily been otherwise. When I started to get interested in contemporary art and to think that it was something that I might really want to pursue, I looked at painting, but I looked at a lot of other things too. And I think if I'm honest with myself, that the reason I started to focus on painting was because I needed something to limit my options. I liked painting as an historical thing. I didn't like the test, but I liked looking at the slides in art history class, and I really enjoyed going to museums and looking at earlier art. I'd made at that time maybe one trip to Italy, so I had a sense about how painting lived over historical time and how it fed into present ideas about painting. But I was really all over the place, and it seemed to me that by accepting painting as a kind of monastic calling, I mean, not in a spiritual sense, but just in a practical sense of, as the term is now in favor, having a practice, you know, that it would allow me to understand what to do next. And it was easy because there were only a very small number of artists at that time who were making contemporary painting that I thought had that really spoke to me. That was the kind of emptied out, very analytical painting that I guess is thought of as part of post-minimalism now. And as with every Oedipal maneuver, there's a lot of ambivalence involved of thinking you know what's good and then figuring out how to kill it off in yourself so you find something of your own there. And I think it was that combination of loving tradition and wanting to find my own way and really wanting to step into a kind of historical continuum. I don't mean that it sounds a little pretentious. It was more the idea that there was something comforting to me in the idea that painting as a culturally understood thing had been in existence for a long time and was part of an ongoing conversation that I could step into. And I think it began as an attempt to find my own sort of the DNA that would allow me to believe that I was making something meaningful. And it's very hard to get the sense in giant slides of the tentative, handmade kind of funkiness of the kinds of things that paintings really are. But I was very interested in the physical part of making things too. And it was something I wanted to, I knew that I really couldn't fully embrace an attitude that was, well, that we would think of as conceptual art, I suppose, because I had this part of myself that I needed to give life to that was interested in making things. What I didn't know, I guess I somehow intuited it, but I didn't consciously know it, was that painting is this sort of self-perpetuating thing once you get into it. I know that's true of all art, but I'm trying to really think and speak specifically about painting because I do think there are things in painting that attract people to it and also put people off it. You know, there a lot of the reasons I'm drawn to painting are exactly the same reasons that a lot of people can't stand it or can't relate to it at all. But the fact that it was that I had found terms of my own, a kind of DNA that felt true to me, and that I was willing to work on things in a physical sense and also to follow where they took me, and, you know, to sort of follow this trail of breadcrumbs that I was, in a sense, creating myself as I went along. It has a lot to do with intuition and just a sort of, as I said before, a kind of determination to keep going. It's proven to be a very rich and surprising progression of experiences. And I think what I'm showing you is sort of warp speed, nearly 30 years of work. I think of my activity in my studio as finding a territory which probably in every case is a sort of hypothesis about what a painting might look like. And then the things that I make in as series or as discrete bodies of work are my attempt to flesh out the hypothesis, to try to really define the territory as fully as I can for myself. And then something happens where one realizes that it's been exhausted and that there's this feeling of emptiness, of not quite knowing where it goes, not really knowing what a painting by Carol Dunham is meant to look like anymore. And then finding something which invariably, I always feel as though I'm forcing myself to jump ahead to something radical. And I always end up finding the clue to the next breadcrumb in something that I've already done. So there's a completely organic aspect to what I've experienced as my own development of really one foot in front of the next with these sort of stops along the way to flesh things out and to explore a particular type of territory. The result of this set of, you know, personal dispositions and, if you want to say, philosophical attitudes has resulted in my paintings changing quite a bit over the years. I mean, I have realized for a while that when I was 25, I really knew a lot, and I don't know very much now at all, you know? So if I had seen when I was 25 the paintings that I've been making for the last 10 years, I would have thought they were crap, you know? I mean, I don't think I would have understood them at all. But the fact that they've come each, that everything that's come next has come out of what came before, and that that the thing that generates change in my work really isn't the illustration of ideas so much as it is a reaction to what's in the work already, makes it feel in another way like it's always the same. When I started to make paintings, there was never the slightest doubt in my mind that I wanted to make abstract paintings. I thought that was absolutely the farthest out thing that had been posited in modernism, and it never. Plus, I had no facility at all for, you know, drawing things that I saw. My interest in drawing from adolescence onward had been much more of the doodly, you know, smoke pot and noodle around sort of idea about drawing, more than the, you know, I'm going to draw that tree kind of drawing. And so it never was even a question to me that I was working in this tradition of modernist abstraction, but there were disconnects built into what I was doing, which I didn't really recognize until they sort of came up and bit me, having to do with the desire to make things that were extremely evocative of aspects of life. You know, I didn't see a lot of, the whole tradition of surrealism within modernism is probably as close to what I'm talking about as one would, in terms of a historical category. I thought of myself as kind of beyond that and thinking about things much more in a process and material within that sort of paradigm, but trying to bring these ideas about bright color, emotional content, arbitrary decision making into things that were more formally rigorous. And when this kind of stuff started to, this is from around the time of the painting that's upstairs, from that this point forward, the terms of the deal for me didn't really change, but I know that it could appear as though there was a sort of choice involved to begin to make things that were pictures of things. I think it's very different to make pictures of things coming out of abstraction than it is to make abstractions of things coming out of the visible world. But that's a long, complicated subject. In some way, I still think of myself as making abstract painting. And I know that my attempts to explain what I'm doing to myself have much more to do with thinking about how to make things and thinking about their structural properties than they have to do with questions of subject matter or narrative. And any time I've ever had the idea to illustrate something that was vaguely narrative or to... Basically, every time I've ever had the idea to make a painting, it's been a disaster. The only way I can find my paintings is in my paintings. And so a lot of the things that... There's a whole process of knocking down one's own resistance that, you know, my experience of painting or of artwork is that it's more like channeling than it is like thinking. You know, I think a lot about art. I look at a lot of other people's art and I think about it. And I guess my hope is that if I'm thinking about their art, they'll think about my art and everything will be good. Because, you know, I don't really want to, I can think about my art pretty well. Like when I see the painting upstairs, I made it 10 years ago. I have a sort of distance on it, and I remember what my life was like then, and I guess what else was going on in the world to a certain extent. And I can see how it might have, that those things might have all affected each other. But at the time, all I felt was I have this enormous canvas in my studio, and I'm going to make something, and I kind of know what continent I'm on right now in terms of what my painting hypothesis is. And I kept this giant canvas around in my studio. For me, a giant canvas. It's the biggest painting I've ever made. I kept it in my studio while I was working on other things, and I would go to it when I felt I knew what to do, and then I would leave it when I was at some sort of crossroads or blocked. And eventually out of that came that painting. I knew that it was going to be an image of a ship, because at that time I had a sort of rudimentary vocabulary of subjects that I used to jump into paintings. But they were basically recontextualizations of shapes and forms that had existed in my work before they were really subjects. And I think the story or the subject was really almost the equivalent of a formal principle, like really just a way to get to work. And in the last few years, I've been pretty under the control of this image of this male character with the phallus growing out of his head and certain fashion attributes, which I can recognize as, I think there's a kind of homeless vocabulary in my work, which probably is very deeply wired in, that gives this, kind of brings back the same forms, the same ideas about composition, but it evolves through different ideas of the physical part of painting and appears to take on the character of different subjects when in fact there's some set of structural archetypes that are kind of locked in that I think I'm at the mercy of. And I think much more about different ways of manifesting this thing, this image, this desire to make a painting. I've been exploring a lot of that in the last few years, of making relatively clean, organized looking paintings and paintings that are a big mess and whose subject matter in some way reflects their nature as a big mess. When I heard the title of this discussion tonight, what is painting, my first reaction was, you know, if you have to ask, you probably shouldn't hear the answer. But then I decided to approach it more constructively. And I thought, to close, I would read, I've created my own definition of painting, which is only two sentences long. So here it is. Painting is a relatively recent manifestation of humanity's ancient effort to understand and exploit pictorial space, generally understood to consist of sheets of colored paste spread manually across primarily rectilinear planar supports, embodying illusionistic or quasi-narrative properties, although each of the previous characteristics had been challenged and contradicted to great theoretical and expressive effect without the loss of basic categorical integrity. Testimony to painting's nature as both bounded and infinite, and its ability to absorb apparently conflicting attitudes on the part of its creators. Painting operates at the nexus of inner subjective experience and consensual reality, relying on both for its subject matter while remaining stubbornly self-referential, and its content extends into the areas we call psychological, social, material in both the philosophical and economic senses of the word, and, for lack of a better term, spiritual, giving it unusual utility as a tool for studying the evolution of the self, of sociocultural systems, and of the complex reciprocities between the two, strikingly manifest in the apparent disconnect within painting's dual nature as potentially both a symbolic repository of capital and a facilitator of profound contemplation, a perfect storm of the crass, the sacred, and the intimately personal. So now you know what it is.
I was struck by, Tip and I have known each other for a long time, and I was struck by how many things he said that I feel are applicable to my own work and how it happens. And crumbs along a trail is a metaphor that I use a great deal, and the whole kind of belief in just working, and the fact that stuff comes out of working, and how different that is from dreaming something up and then executing it. I've always said that that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. And if you wait for the clouds to part and for a bolt of lightning to hit you, and for a great art idea, you can wait the whole of your life and never have anything particular to do. But if you do sign on to some sort of process, no matter how silly sometimes it seems, sometimes I think, look at my work, and I think, can a grown-up person be making stuff this goofy? I mean, is this serious art, you know? But, so I was thinking about what is painting, and actually Tip said it far more beautifully than I would, but it's almost exactly the same. It's I was going to say that it's colored dirt smeared on a flat surface, usually stretched around some wooden sticks, and that it is, for me, the most magical of all mediums. You smear that colored dirt, and it makes space where there is no space. It allows you to make associations with life experiences that you've had, and actual, you know, paintings can actually make you cry, and it's just colored dirt smeared on a flat surface. It can make people feel religious. They can bow down in front of them. They can be transformed to another place that they've never been but only can imagine. But there are many things about painting which make it special. Sculpture occupies real space, like you and me, and you can walk around it, or in my case, roll around it. And it has a kind of object status. It is there. Painting, on the other hand, has always the tension between its physicality, that is, its actual evidence of its own making, and things that it transcends towards, things that transcends its physical reality. And the best thing about painting, and I think Tip would probably agree with this, is it's always unfinished before it's finished. It's always wrong before it's right, which means that you, unlike photography, where you can stick a piece of paper into a bath and it all comes up at once, and there it is, or other things like video or whatever, where it is, in essence, finished before you start, you can play around with it, but it is whole and it is complete. And you never get a chance to see what it would be like if you had done something else in the process. What if I hadn't put this in? You see the effect that everything you drop into the painting has. And you say, well, do I really want that? Did that help? Now what am I going to do? I put something down here, I better do something up there. And that magical transcendence is so rooted in process. no painting ever got made without a process. Some paintings have more evidence of what happened and how it happened, but there's touch, this hand, or every attempt to remove touch and hand and make it appear like an apparition that just floated on the canvas. I have any idea how Vermeer gets made? I mean, you look at it, it's magical. You don't know. I made a lot of paintings. I've looked at a lot of Vermeers. I still don't know how those things get there. It's just like happened. But usually embedded in the painting is all of the evidence of its own making that we can call sort of its physicality. One of the reasons why a show like this is so important is, as opposed to simply being reproductions in a catalog or things that you might have studied in art history, they are juxtaposed with each other, and its juxtaposition makes you aware of differences in physicality and difference in touch and difference in hand and how they're related and how they're not related. So for me, I think this kind of show is... I have to love shows that are curated like this. There's no reason for it to exist. There's no overarching theory or anything that you're beaten to death with. But you're invited to enjoy the dialogue between works as they chatter with one another. And I think the future of museum exhibitions is precisely this. First of all, exhibitions are very expensive to put together. You borrow pieces from other museums and you bring them here, and you have to insure them, and you have to have couriers bring them from wherever it is. The modern already owns all this stuff. They're already paying the rent. They're already paying the insurance. But a fresh take on familiar work sometimes takes you closer to understanding it than historical shows, or what I call the sort of Old Testament version of art history, which the modern used to be very good at. So-and-so begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, a kind of straight line through art history. And a lot of people didn't make it onto that highway. They were off on rest stops, and they were not considered part of the mainstream. And what is interesting for me is how works recontextualized mean different things than you ever had noticed in those paintings before, and how important it is to be in front of the actual work of art. That the difference, that the only thing that's reproducible in a catalog or in a book or anything else is iconography. There's no indication of how big the painting is, what kind of touch or hand is there, the relative opacity or transparency of the paint. All those issues, all you get is iconography, which is why art history focuses so much on iconography. This is, I always thought the history of art should be called the history of slides. They're just rendered scaleless, blown up, transparent. You have no idea of its physicality. So I really enjoy being in a show, and I love the fact that Anne Omlin did the show. Anne is a great friend of art and friend of artists. She likes artists so much that she actually married one, which is going way beyond the Call of Duty, I think. But I think you have a different point of view, because you are and have been, as you said earlier while we're having a drink, you were first an artist's wife, and you said, ooh, I think I still am. but it does make for a different kind of approach when you're part of that world and always have been part of that world. Anyhow, a really quick trip through. Aren't you glad I didn't keep it on the screen for the whole time that I was talking? How does art happen? I was a good student. I knew what art looked like. Once you know what art looks like, it's not hard to make some of it. The trouble is that it's going to look like someone else's art, or it doesn't look like art. And this was before appropriation. When I made art that looked like somebody's art, I was simply a student and simply copying it or working through it or whatever. It was there was nothing ironic about it. There was nothing that is typical of late 70s appropriation. What my generation of artists wanted to do was to purge their work of every last association with another artist's work that you could. And you didn't want anybody standing in front of your work thinking about anybody else's work. And so we tried to figure out how we could push ourselves into some idiosyncratic personal corner where nobody else's work was relevant. I think in art and in life and in society, problem solving is way too overrated. Problem creation is much more interesting. If you can ask yourself an interesting enough question, no one else's answers will fit, and you'll have to go out and figure out your own reasons for making it. And we often don't know what we want to do, but we sure as hell know what we don't want to do. So the choice not to do something is very often more important than the choice to do something. And self-imposed limitations and other guarantees that you will not make what you used to make can easily be engineered into the studio practice. And for that, Ad Reinhardt is a real hero. He made lists of things you can't do anymore. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. He made the choice not to do something a positive decision. And it's a great modus operandi for how to move and progress, not necessarily progress up, but program change into your work. And this work is the first, I did a nude just before this. It was about 22 feet long, but the first stuff that I did based on photographs, because I didn't want to do what I did when I was in graduate school. I was given praise and scholarships and whatever for knowing what art looked like, and that meant I could make shapes that looked like art. They looked like other people's art, but it looked like art. I was rewarded for having a good sense of color, which meant that I learned that certain color combinations look more like art than other color combinations. And that certain kinds of gestures or marks were arty. They looked, they had just whatever. So what I tried to do was to purge my work of all my bad habits and all my tools with which I had a facility, and get tools with which I had no history and no track record and no facility whatsoever. And I got rid of brushes, all my favorite brushes. Oh, I loved those brushes too. I mean, they were like, got rid of them. I got rid of my so-called good sense of color, and I decided to just make a painting with black and white, or actually just black. And that it's thinned down and to make grays. And I wanted to get rid of my hand, so I got an airbrush, which just sprays stuff. Instead of relying on my taste and making art shapes, I wanted something very specific to do. So because I couldn't stop making de Kooning shapes, I had to get a photograph and make it a goddamn ear. And maybe the ear would look like an harp, but it was going to look like an ear also. So this was an effort to make a big, aggressive, confrontational image. I was in there early with the grunge look. Big, aggressive, confrontational painting that you can see from a distance, but that would suck you up close to it, and that you would have another kind of experience of which the tension between the distribution of marks on a flat surface and the image it warped into. I've never liked the word realist because I was just as interested in the artificial as I was in the real. And it's the tension between the flat distribution of paint on a flat surface and the image it warps into that interests me. Now, I tried to paint. I didn't want to make Andy Warhol superstars or I didn't want to do commissioned portraits of CEOs and college presidents. Phil Glass said that and I love this quote, he said, "He is to me what haystacks were to Monet or bottles to Mirandi. He was simply subject matter." And I've recycled Phil about, maybe 100 times from the same 1968 photograph. Every time I look at it with something else to do, I find different stuff embedded in that photograph. But anyhow, my effort to make anonymous everyday people was screwed up by the fact that everybody I painted managed to get famous on me almost immediately. So it's Phil Glass and Richard Serra. After I've worked with only black and white for a while, am I using too much time? Okay. After working with black and white for some time, I decided to let what variable could I alter? Should I paint motorcycles instead of people? Should I paint, something else? I decided that the one variable that was the least interesting to alter was subject matter. That was not going to change what I did in the studio each day. If I was going to change my experience in the studio, I had to change the conditions under which painting was made. So I decided I wanted to put color back in the paintings, but I didn't want to fall back into old, de Kooning-esque color combinations. And I had discovered when I made those black and white paintings, only spraying black paint on a white canvas, that the paint actually mixed on the canvas itself. There was no palette. So all the decisions were made in context, adjacent to completed areas and anticipation of areas yet to be done. And so wrong before it's right, unfinished before it's finished. You can't leave purple lips, Or I guess you could, but I wouldn't. So it means that I have to stay there and keep working until I got what I wanted. And on the left, you see the dye transfer color separations that I worked from, which showed me the relative amount of red, blue, and yellow. And the painting is actually made by making a complete red painting, putting a complete blue painting on top of that, and a yellow painting on top of that, where all the paint mixed within the rectangle in context. That's what the final painting was. Again, a very goofy image for a supposed adult to have made. This is Robert from the show upstairs with 104,000 and however many dots. I was trying to make portraits that didn't have hierarchy, that the nose, the eyes, and the mouth were important and everything else didn't matter. The portraits incorporated notion of make a portrait. They know what you're buying. You're buying the features. They don't care how you paint the shirt, So I wanted to make paintings which didn't have hierarchy. Every square inch had to physically be made out of the same mark. I wanted to get rid of virtuoso art marks. No mark was more interesting than any other mark. No mark had some virtuoso dramatic flair. It was just a stupid, inarticulate mark. And clusters of them built a situation that read like hair. No mark was symbolic. No mark stood for hair. There were just the same stupid dots. But clusters of them built a situation that read like hair. I tried to look for every kind of mark-making method, every incremental unit that I could. I decided that I would use my fingers. The thumb and forefinger are a standard incremental unit that I could ink up and press onto the painting and build out of incremental units. Rob Storr, when I had my retrospective here, and his catalog essay, which I thought was really a wonderful notion, was that he said that it's skin making skin. I thought I was making art that couldn't be forged. And that I was essentially caressing the face of the person that I loved. And people wonder how you can make something out of with your fingers. But in fact, usually we feel through a tool. You have to feel through a pencil, feel through a brush. You're already 6-8 inches away from the surface. If you ink up your body and your body becomes a tool, you can really feel how much paint you're applying. And I loved being my own tool. I did things like make pulp paper pieces. Accidentally, I dropped a pulp on the floor. It would harden into little chips about the size of Pringles. They happened to be dark gray, light gray, whatever. I started to pick them up, and I realized that I might want to make collages from a found incremental unit that was found by gravity. The plop of that pulp on the floor gave it an irregular outside edge, and I collected them. And then I went into kind of David's cookie mode where I started manufacturing the chips, which you see in the bowls here. And then I built an image out of incremental units that again, had none of the characteristics of the thing it was portraying. And that's what a final collage looks like. I finally decided to go back to oil painting. I hadn't made oil painting since I was in graduate school. But I didn't want to fall into those habits again. And I tried to think about the grid, which in this case, the grid is about half an inch, three quarters of an inch square. That allowed me to get one or two colors or three maybe into each square. And there's underpainting, and then there's some correction that goes on top of it. And I sort of made something which basically was almost the generic color. The paint was the color of the thing it was being portrayed, pretty much. I played around with other grid forms. So this is this kind of spin art version of Lucas Samaras, in which the grid actually is circular instead of rectangular. And also then it emanates from his third eye. And if you know Lucas Samaras, he would be the Ayatollah if you could run for the job of Ayatollah. And mind control is something that he practices daily on his victims. As the squares got bigger, I realized that I could make a highly unlikely palette make skin color. So it was more interesting for me to capriciously and arbitrarily put down a color that is so unlike skin that in a series of four or five or six correcting colors going on top of it, I move it from where it's wrong towards what it's right in a sort of ideal number of discrete correcting moves. And the difference is that it's mixing color in a palette and dropping it into the painting is like shooting an arrow directly at a bullseye. You hope that the decision you made out of context will be the right one when it goes into context. I wanted to find the color in the rectangle. I wanted to make all the adjustments and corrections and changes right there. So by having unlikely colors, the corrections that go on top have to be different in every possible square. And then you see this painting of John, it's a very bleached out slide, I'm sorry, of John Chamberlain finally resolved. Now sometimes the grid is horizontal vertical and sometimes it's diagonal. If I had done Roy in a diagonal grid, his nose would have been a ski jump, a straight line. So iconography would be the same. And in fact, reproduced in a book, you would not know the difference, perhaps, between a painting done with a diagonal grid or one done with a horizontal vertical grid. But experientially, what's the difference? Because it's horizontal vertical, your eye splashes down his nose like water over rocks in a waterfall. And that's a very different experience than a straight line. So I wanted to make things where the experience of being in front of the painting was not determined necessarily by the iconography, but how the imagery had been pushed through a process that altered our experiences when we were in front of it. Don DeLillo said, if you think Hemingway is about bullfights, you'd understand what makes Hemingway a great writer. The use of the word the and the is more important than the imagery. that the imagery is often very hackneyed, but the experience is how the words roll off the tongue and how clusters of words build an image in your mind and transport you and take you someplace else. And that's what I think painting does. The systems, every painting is made with a system, the systems build experiences for the viewer. It's different because you do it one way rather than another way, even if the iconography stays the same. There you see his nose. That also allowed me to make a square jaw, which was a sort of comment on Dick Tracy or Fearless Fosdick, and for Roy Lichtenstein, a man who made an entire career out of working for comic books. I thought it was an apt kind of conceit. This is a self-portrait that's here in the Moderns collection. Never up on the wall often enough, Anne. See what you can do about that. Must be room in a restaurant or something. And you can see by now that the squares are about 3 or 4 inches, 3.5 inches square, allowing me to put 4, 5, 6, or 7 colors into each one. But again, very much like those early paintings, there are no marks that make hair. There are no marks that make glass or skin. It's just things that melt, as we used to say in the 60s, things that melt in your mind, not in your hand. I used to hate biomorphic art and shapes like that. I just hated all that stuff. And I loved de Kooning, and I wanted to make things like that. When I finally met de Kooning, I said, it's really nice to meet somebody who made a few more de Koonings than I made. But getting rid of de Kooning was the hardest thing that I ever did. But the wonderful thing about the way I work now is I get a chance to make these really kind of wonderfully odd and goofy shapes, the Coke bottle shapes, condom shapes, you know, things like that, or all those kind of really kind of silly stuff. And I get to use all the de Kooning color and biomorphic shapes, and I get to use all the stuff that I loved most at art history, but it doesn't look like de Kooning and it doesn't look like all my heroes. I found a way to incorporate the things that I love most in art, which I hope is specifically mine. I hope that didn't take too long.
Well, my thanks to you both, especially for both tackling the deliberately sophomoric and definitely dumb question of the title. I couldn't have asked for more, in a way, or less. And I wondered, between the two definitions you proffered, I mean, one thing that I picked up upon was in Carroll's, was the notion both of painting as a vehicle for transport or for contemplation, but as symbolic as a repository for capitalism, if I'm getting the wording right. This.
Well, I said capital.
Capital, all right. But capital, like this complicity. And I wondered, Chuck, if that figured in any way for you, or do you think that's something particular to a subsequent generation?
Well, I think capitalism has a lot to do with a subsequent, subsequent generation, but we had very lowered expectations about making any money. I'd be interested in how Tip defines capital in this way.
I just wanted to point out, I mean, the conceit behind my definition was a little facetious because, you know, I There's a lot crammed into two sentences. But,
it was impressive.
I feel that, like, one of the things about painting is something that's very specific to different cultures, you know, mm-hmm. And we have a tradition that's grounded in European culture and evolved into American culture. And American culture is very driven by the movement of capital. And the fact that when one is making art, one is involved with an extremely private, contemplative, and not risky in an overly romantic sense, but risky, a personally risky activity. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee of success on any meaningful terms. And I'm not talking about material success. I'm talking about the feeling that one is doing something that feels useful and true. And that navigating the space between that and the public side of being an artist is complex. Mm-hmm. And that's really all I was trying to allude mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. It's too complex for me.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts about that. First of all, society values it enough to keep it. And in a museum, you hope that your work only goes down into the basement when it goes out of favor. Not that it's de-accessed or, as long as it's down in the basement, some enterprising curator or graduate student or something is like liable to kick into it and haul the stuff back upstairs. I mean, I think that we're orchestrators of experience, and we hope that people are engaged. I mean, Duchamp said, and you don't even think of Duchamp this way, but he said that the artist has only 50% of the responsibility, and that's to get the work out, but it's completed by the viewer, and when the viewer returns it to him. And I think we're involved in communication, so it's essential that the work is out in front of people. Mm-hmm. And so there are various mechanisms and various institutions. Used to be the church. Used to have Christ's knees go this way and the donor in the lower left-hand corner. And art historians make that. I hate to pick on art historians, but art historians make it seem like it's great because his knees go to the right and the donor. In fact, it's a miracle that the goddamn painting is any good at all, considering all the stuff that they had to put mm-hmm. into these things. But, you know, if you start with Lascaux and it had people throwing spears at bulls or something, and so that when they go out into the world, they can actually throw a real spear at a real bull. Art has had this kind of magical ability to make people think about stuff, darkened space with candles flickering and images of God and whatever, and now we have corporations making collections and how that work is used to define a company which is enlightened and Maybe we launder their image, the polluters, the people who do produce oil and stuff like that. But I've worked very hard to get the work into public collections, and that's because I was a person of no means, no financial means, poor white trash mill town in the state of Washington. And when I came to New York and I saw all this stuff, it was a smorgasbord of experiences laid out in front of me, and consequently, I think like I own. I'm not acquisitive. I have no collection to speak of. I don't really want to own art. Thank God other people do. But I already feel like I own every work of art in the world. I don't have to physically have possession of them. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that, the fact that you can possess in your mind's eye and in your memory bank and in your experiences and the things where you've been in front of an object. And, I mean, I love sculpture. I probably liked sculpture more than I liked painting, but I was never any good at it. But there is this really kind of amazing thing about painting, that when you're in front of it, and it's a record of decisions that somebody made, mm-hmm. that is, you are vicariously watching those decisions. Mm-hmm. And it's like you pull a rabbit out of the hat, but you can also see how they pull a rabbit out of the hat. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very, very special. Especially, and I love photography, but there is no physicality to a photograph. There is no evidence of the hand. There is manipulation. But.
I mean, I'm curious, Carol, to hear, you've both spoke of picking up the crumbs, of working, stuff comes out of the working, out of the making, and to ask if it is, it's the paint, the physical process of painting that makes that picking up the crumbs possible. Is that
over? That's the way paintings happen. But I don't think I would really say that. I mean, much as I enjoy having the sort of craft level of mm-hmm. painting, it's one of the things that drew me to it. I've completely made up my own craft. You know, there's no, there's no one way that it needs to happen. And I think part of moving forward is thinking about different ways it could happen. Mm-hmm. But I think of it more as moving through philosophical problems than I do through technical ones. Having a philosophy about making things.
I don't suppose you'd like to try two sentences about that.
No, I don't know how. It's sort of like when you start talking about art, you get in this thing where you have to define every term in the sentence, mm-hmm. and then you've got a lot more than two sentences. Mm-hmm. In the way that Chuck's generation was demonized by New York school painting, mm-hmm. my generation was demonized by conceptual art. Mm-hmm. So while I've gone quite far from that, I know that I'm still a kind of cerebral artist in a way. Mm-hmm. And that having a studio activity that involves making things is a sort of philosophical choice more than. Mm-hmm.
But you did use the word intuition a couple of times, and I think you can put yourself into a position where you, philosophy notwithstanding, where you really are functioning in a very intuitive.
Oh, absolutely.
Way.
Because I, you know, as I, if I didn't say it explicitly, I should have. I've never had a good idea in my life. You know, it's all sort of following your nose, mm-hmm. and it gets very.
So I'm willing to actually embrace the dreaded C word, craft. It is the most despised, the most. Ridiculed word in painting, craft. I'm enamored of.
I thought decorative was.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah, craft is decorative mostly, but I'm enamored of what used to be called women's work. I love processes that you sign on to, like crocheting and knitting and making quilts and afghans. The reason is I am such a nervous wreck and I am so learning disabled that I do not want to reinvent the wheel every day. And I want to sign on to that process and know for the next 3 or 4 months that today I'll do what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'm going to do what I do today. And if I just stay there long enough, if you knit one and purl two long enough and believe in it, you get a sweater. And to me, this calms me down. It's like raking gravel in a Zen Buddhist garden, and then it allows me to be far more intuitive and more inventive than I ever was when I was free to do anything I wanted. When I was free to do anything I wanted, I made the same shapes over and over, used the same colors over and over, formulaic, just whatever. My giving myself over to a process like that has allowed me more permutations, more change, more invention, more intuition than I ever had before.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as though limits or constraints set up a space for the creative act. Is that a...
Well, that's what I found so appealing or so attractive about painting in the beginning, was the sense that it had a perimeter. And that once I was operating within that area, I could go up against it. But it gave me a real feeling of focus for my energies.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the parameters as opposed to the perimeter?
Well, starting with this kind of premise that it's a flat rectangle with paint on it, and trying to understand what could possibly be meaningful about that in the cultural, historical context of 1970 whatever in New York City, and then trying to both acknowledge and subvert the examples I saw of what I thought addressed that. That was a beginning. And then, you know, it just goes.
To keep. So I'm curious. We've heard the word used purge, and I was wondering if there are names to be named or things to be said, or did you think in those terms?
Purge.
To purge influences, to the things that you chose not to do.
When I came up in the 60s, 68 seemed like a watershed year. Every institution was reassessed or disposed of completely. And a sense that all things that were old were corrupt, and we're building this new thing. And you think about what sculptors like Richard Serra upstairs did, was he chose not to use stone, wax, wood, clay, bronze, any traditional art material, which had so much baggage, which we couldn't think of anything except how it had been used. And so, you know, he went to Canal Street and he got rubber and he brought it home and he lifted it up and it stood there. Or he, you know, got some lead, and what do you do with it? You can roll it up, you can lean it, you can shred it, you can do all kinds of stuff. And there was a very similar thing in the cross-fertilization of ideas, because we were hanging out with composers, with filmmakers, with choreographers, and there was this sense that all the rules were out the window. And what you needed to do was to purge the work of the baggage that you brought with you into the studio. And therefore, you would strip the viewer of the baggage, art historical baggage and associated baggage that they brought with them into the gallery. We never assumed we'd be in a museum, but into the gallery, we hoped. And I think that's what, when I use the word purge, Not only did you purge aspects of your own work which you found that you didn't like or that you thought were not helping, but you tried to purge in the larger sense of getting rid of shop-worn ideas and things to make a figurative painting. And it was nothing was painting was dead. Figurative painting was even deader. Only an idiot would make a portrait. And I didn't want to breathe new life into 19th century notions of painting and figuration and portraiture. You know, and there were heroes for me, like people like Andy Warhol and Alex Katz, who'd found truly contemporary modernist notions of building a figurative painting. And we just tried to build on that.
I think every generation, I mean, certainly within the modern period, I suspect it goes back further than that, every generation of artists sets up sort of defines themselves in terms of what went before and gets involved in a certain amount of admiration for that, and then has to knock it down in order to find something that's authentic for them. You know, the equivalent for me of Chuck's relationship to de Kooning Schmiers was rulers and right angles. I mean, I when I think back on it, it amazes me that it didn't ever occur to me to do a painting of a girl on the telephone, because, you know, it would have been the most antagonistic thing imaginable to what I already held dear. But instead, I found my way in by undermining the sort of nuts and bolts of the process. You know, like no grids, no white, no gray, no measurement, none of the things that no systems. Which, of course, is a system itself, which is part of the paradox. But what can you do?
Then you talked about going to Italy. But then you find yourself skipping over generations and finding things that have urgency.
Well, it becomes very personal.
That you can pick out of art history. I mean, I when I was living in Rome recently, I decided to go up to Ravenna to look at the Byzantine mosaics. I thought I'd make a pilgrimage to look at how they'd done these things. And I got up there, I hated them. I thought, oh my, look at them. They can't even see them. They're way up there. They're in the dark. You can't see the individual tesserae. They all just, they glittered. And I hated them. So I thought, oh my God, you know, here were my precursors. Here are the things that I thought. But what I discovered in Rome was how much I loved the humble Roman floor mosaics. And why? Because your viewing distance is your own height. And the insistent flatness of the floor and the fact that it's just stones is always there. It might warp into a lion, but pretty soon it's going to flatten back out and be stones again. And I thought, well, this is precisely what I'm doing. This across the centuries, I got a chance to see a record of decisions made by, it was a contemporary experience, as if I were looking over his shoulder, watching him lay that floor. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the great things about being an artist is that that you can have a historical piece have contemporary urgency for you if it's useful.
And if it's useful, yeah.
Yeah. And you're not locked into your time. You don't have to go into the sandbox with all the other kids and play nice. You can.
Well, also part of that, you know, that the certainty of the way young people think they know things, for me, has eroded over time, and I find that I don't always even know what I can make use of. A lot of artists' work that I at one point found completely uninteresting or really bad, something will tumble in my head, and I'll just see it as very useful. And that's a very nice experience to have. And it doesn't really have to do with keeping up with contemporary things. It has more to do with finding a personal
And when you have connection. A good day in the gallery and you see some work you really like, whether it has anything to do with your work at all or not, or maybe it's something that is something you don't normally respond to, but you see something that really shows you something, and it makes you want to go home and paint. It doesn't make you want to compete with them. It doesn't make you want to throw away what you're doing. Their work makes you want to do what you do. And I think that's the community. That's what the role of the community of artists. This is why we all live in cities next to each other instead of being, you know, out where real estate is cheap. And you know, we need to live where people think this activity is a really good activity, where this really matters, where this we're playing marbles for keeps. You know, if you teach in the university system out somewhere and you got your 10-year track and you got all of that stuff and you make station wagon-sized art that you put in the faculty show, you're playing marbles, but you're not playing marbles for keeps. We want to go where the yardstick for judgment is an agreed-upon set of conditions and traditions and values and things that we've all signed on to, and then question. And that's why we want to play in this with this mix of ideas.
Well, I think if it's all right with the two of you, that's actually a perfect way to open this discussion up to our larger community here and our audience, and to ask if anyone has questions for either Tip or Chuck. Yes.
I know it comes with a definition that perhaps, you know, where I'm not understanding. But anyway, in your iconic character with his phalluses and his guns and all, what in your philosophy, you know, informs that? I mean,
the philosophy of getting out of my own way and letting my work tell me what it wants to be. I don't have. I can't really unpack that yet. It's too much what I've been doing. It's too recent. I don't believe that I should, to the extent that I can avoid it, I don't believe I should censor myself. So if something seems to present itself to me and make sense within as painting, I should try to explore it. And that's more it, the when I use the term philosophy, it's really a failure to know a better word to use. I just mean to characterize the activity as something quite reflective and inward, inner-directed, rather than illustrative or outer-directed.
Can I hazard a an interpretation of what you do and see if
you knock yourself out, Chuck?
That seems to me that what you've done in your work is sort of create a stage on which you've invited these characters to act out, and that you don't even know what they're going to do.
Well, that's true. You are correct, sir. I think that's exactly right. So why did I have to speak for so long?
To get to that point, because it was.
I should lecture on your work, you should lecture on my work.
Well, this is what I said. If other people look at what I do and I look at what other people do, everything should be fine.
Yes?
Would you say that the resentments or sort of cartoons or any influence of cartoons?
In a really generic sort of way. I mean, I didn't watch any more or less of that stuff You know, I'm the first television generation and certainly spent enough time looking at Looney Tunes and Disney and all of that when I was younger. I'm not interested in it particularly as an idea. You know, I think there's a lot of cartooning within modernism that hasn't really been explicitly discussed. If you think about the relationship of certain periods of Matisse to earlier notions of rendering in painting, I think you can see a sort of trend towards simplification and the reliance on outline and things that I guess I see myself as just being part of some longer train of thought in painting.
Is there anything more cartoon-like than Giotto's frescoes in Padua?
Well, exactly.
In those strips.
And they're even constructed in the panels. Yes, absolutely. I mean, when painting was more tied to architecture and wasn't a portable thing, there was much more of a sense of narrative constructed from image to image, and exactly what Chuck's talking about, which is the way comic books work. So I think the relationship between painting and cartoons and comics is really complicated and rich. And I don't have any special, I don't claim anything there, really.
Yes?
Well, there's the, you know, it is the one-eyed monster, the camera. But we have one of the things that I think can be exploited is the notion how we believe photographic truth when it's never truthful. I mean, there is, you know, it's capable of lying like crazy. And but I wonder now with digital techniques that really create a fiction, whether anybody will believe a photograph from now on anyhow. But I really wanted to make a painting that could not be made from having the person sit in the room with me for 3 months. You know? First of all, I didn't want anybody in the room with me for 3 months. And they're hair would grow long and they'd cut it off, they'd gain weight, they'd lose weight, they'd be happy, they'd be sad, they'd be awake, they'd be asleep. The painting would be a mean average. Eyeball realist, and there was a big, I can't believe how it was so stupid. I was the victim of, like, hate attacks for working for photographs. Those people who really felt that if you worked from life, you were somehow closer to God, and that it was a more noble enterprise. And that I once had a third grade class come to my studio, and this little kid, like, put up his hand and he said, "Can you really draw, or you just copy photographs?" And I thought, you know, like, there it is already. The guy's like, to the third grade, he already's like got this prejudice. So I drew freehand Mickey Mouse with two circles and two more circles for the year. And they went, wow. Yeah. Anything that seems to come out of your head is considered to be invention. And I accept everything that happens in the photograph. That's not where the invention lies. I'm not inventing interesting shapes or interesting color combinations or interesting anything. For me, the invention is invention of means. It is the methodology, the working processes, the invention all lies in the translation from one two-dimensional surface to another. I think it's a very different kind of invention, but I still think it is invention. Somebody said to me once just that Pollock didn't know what he was going... Pollock didn't know what his next painting was going to look like, but he knew specifically what he was going to do in the studio the next day. And I know exactly what my painting is going to look like. It's going to look like that photograph. But I don't know what I'm going to do in the studio the next day. Mm-hmm. So it's where the emphasis on invention lies. Mm-hmm. And
well, you're inventing paintings. I mean, that's when I look at those early things, I'm amazed at how, because I remember the context in which they were being seen and how different they were than so-called photorealist painting because of this, the extreme frontality of them and the scale and the fact that they were so repetitive. Mm-hmm. That actually had a lot in common with ideas in abstraction at the time, it seems to me. But the...
I thought they were always abstract. And also experiential on another kind of level. I mean, I was trying to make a Brobdingnagian world in which Gulliver's Lilliputians could crawl over the face of the giant, know everything that could possibly be known about that face, stumble over a beard hair, fall into a nostril, and still not even, and lose track of the fact that they were even on a face. So I was trying to orchestrate an experience that was almost more landscape than it was a portrait, and a series of experiences as you traverse this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Many of your friends have become famous, but you must know some people who aren't famous, and you generally paint people who are recognizable, at least by name, if not by face.
Well, so, I've painted car salesmen, I've painted Robert, the dot piece, he is a dreaded investment banker guy.
Okay. It makes for an interesting play between the known and the unknown. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly the person who preceded you, is the best known portraitist who preceded you, was Warhol, who, mm-hmm. you know, his choice of subjects was very specific. So it just I'd love for you to say that there really is more intention behind subjects.
Here's what happened.
Or not.
And this is the, this is. As close as I can come to the truth, I think, which is that at first I painted anonymous people, and then they got famous, and I looked for more anonymous people. I looked for people I thought weren't going to have a career, who were just going to, you know, stay anonymous for the rest of their lives. And I picked, you know, a salesman that I met on the beach. I picked my father-in-law. I picked my... So a plastics engineer, you know, and I thought no one will ever know this guy. Then I went into the hospital, and I lay there in bed for 8 months, and the art world showed up for me, and looming at the end of the, over my feet in the darkened room in this disgusting rehabilitation hospital snake pit. I realized that there was another family, not just my own family whom I had painted, my wife, my father-in-law, my children, whatever. But there was this other family, this other sense of community. And I decided at that point that I wanted to celebrate my connectedness. I mean, so many of the first people I painted happened to be artists, and then they became famous. So I said, well, fuck it, they're famous already. I'll just paint them anyhow. So I thought, well, who's really important for me? Well, Roy Lichtenstein's important to me. Alex Cass is important to me. You know, people that I felt, Cindy Sherman, and younger, less well-known, are the last image on the screen was Lyle Ashton Harris, who's not exactly a household name, and I think a really wonderful artist. But I felt like I would paint people that I photographed Tip and his wife, and you know, real artists. And that I wanted to celebrate a sense of connectedness where they weren't necessarily my best friends, but I felt like I had a real dialogue with them through their work. So they had to be important to me, either important because they were my best friends or important because there was some connectedness, some dialogue between our works. And then I loved going out of my own generation, either doing artists who were older than me, who were my heroes, that were in books when I was a student. Paul Cadmus, who was like 85 when I painted him, or, you know, much younger artists who, you know, were still in grade school when I was in graduate school. But I figure, you know, I make the rules and change them.
So I think there's time for one more question. I see three. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's worse. So I have persistently noticed your hand. I'm sorry, the rest of you. So you get to be last, and then we're going.
Thanks. Perhaps this picks up where you just left off, because I was wondering about how both of you think about feeling in the process of doing the work that you do. How does that process somehow relate to something about emotion, if so at all? Or what kind of emotion, perhaps?
I mean, everybody's feeling things all the time. But if you're working on paintings, you know, you could feel crappy one day and feel great the next day, and you're still working on the same painting. So
tell me about it.
So there's something else. I mean, I really think that the content of painting is so multi-layered and so complex that, and I, not just painting, any form of expression, you know, it brings out, you can load feelings into it in some way, but you can't guarantee at all that they're the feelings that someone else looking at it, who's not the maker, will experience. You know, I think, I don't know if Chuck and I see this differently or if it's a matter of vocabulary. You know, I don't really invoke the concept of the viewer with myself. And it's a rhetorical device that I just choose not to use, because I really do think that it's fundamentally sort of me, myself, and I, and then the rest follows. And it's not that I don't know that if I put my work in an art gallery that other people will see it. I just really don't want to think much about it. And I think that the relationship between feeling and painting is highly overrated, frankly. Or overdrawn.
I have feelings about someone shooting his asshole off with a gun.
Well, that's your problem.
Ooh, that was smart.
All right. So I think on that note, we're going to thank everyone. Thank you all.
I have feelings about...